Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, restoring internet freedom or the end of net neutrality? I guess it depends on how you look at it. But after today's announcements, we're recording on Tuesday, November 21st, the FCC is set to roll back internet regulations passed in 2015 under the previous administration. Now, critics are sounding the alarm with breathless headlines saying it's the end of the internet as we know it. But proponents of the rollback, including FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, say these rules were unnecessary and have stifled innovation and investment in broadband networks. Well, whatever your view, it'd be good to hear from the man himself. So we're delighted to welcome FCC Chairman Ajit Pai to the show. Mr. Chairman, thanks for coming back.
Hey, good to see you, Evan, and you too, Baron.
I know you have so much time these days, so I really appreciate you coming. And Tech Freedom President Baron Soka, to make this a little bit less complicated. Baron, thanks for joining.
That's my goal.
So the big picture here, you have said the internet was not broken before 2015 and that there was no reason to pass these rules. Yet, can you really say the internet is broken now? What are you trying to accomplish, given that there are so many people who say they like these rules and startups saying it's important for them to their businesses to make sure that the big bad ISPs don't block their traffic or discriminate against them? What are you trying to accomplish by getting rid of these rules if everything kind of seems all right now?
What we're trying to accomplish is to free up that so-called virtuous cycle where both network operators and innovators have the maximum incentive to invest and innovate on this online platform that's delivered so much digital value for consumers over the last several decades. And one of the things we found as we looked through the record is that these heavy-handed regulations that were adopted on a party line vote by the Obama administration's FCC have had an impact. They have dissuaded some companies from investing, especially smaller companies that are helping to close the digital divide. They've inhibited innovation in terms of companies' willingness to explore more consumer-friendly business plans, things like free data offerings. And so going forward, we want to, as I said, maximize the incentive for every private company of every kind to be able to invest and innovate to benefit consumers going forward.
So there are some parts of, you know, so-called net neutrality that are less controversial than others. And we've heard prominent Republicans in Congress and, you know, former FCC commissioners and chairmen and, you know, groups like Tech Freedom say it's not every aspect of net neutrality regulation that's bad. There are so-called good parts. But it looks like the order removes most, if not all, of what the prior FCC passed. So why not keep in some of those less controversial aspects, those, quote, good parts like no blocking, no discrimination, things that pretty much everyone agrees are bad? Why not just keep those in? Why take such a weed whacker, to use your own words, so to speak?
For two reasons. Number one, we found that we do not have a legal basis for retaining some of these rules. So we reject Title II, for example, as a source of authority. We find that broadband internet access is best interpreted as an information service, which I know is an arcane distinction for folks who might be listening, but essentially it means that the light touch approach as an information service is how we should think about broadband. We also find that Section 706 of the Telecom Act is not a grant of independent regulatory authority for the commission. It was adopted 20 some years ago by the Congress as a deregulatory measure. But we do find that we have authority to retain the so-called transparency rule with some modifications. And so if an internet service provider is engaging in certain business practices, we simply want those to be disclosed and for the Federal Trade Commission to have enforcement authority to back up those promises.
So by disclaiming this legal authority, the practical effect will be that net neutrality will move from a Federal Communications Commission, FCC, issue to a Federal Trade Commission, FTC, issue. Some have raised concerns that since the FTC has not been thinking about net neutrality since the FCC took control of the issue in 2007, under a Republican chairman, mind you, that they don't have the experts, they don't have the people there to prevent bad behavior, to really discuss it intelligently and make sure that consumers are protected. So yes, I understand you don't think the FCC has authority. Some courts have said that it does, maybe ancillarily, but aren't you worried that the FTC is not capable of dealing with this issue the way that your agency is?
To me, it's an absurd suggestion for any number of reasons. Number one, the FTC itself submitted comments in this proceeding, and they made clear that they have both the expertise and the experience necessary to protect consumers and competition going forward. Secondly, if you look at some of that experience, and we cite it in the order, they've initiated some of the investigations into things like throttling and, you know, the TracFone case, for example. And so they, I think, do have the capability of handling these issues. Additionally, we have to also think about the cost in terms of who is doing the regulating and when they're regulating it. So the approach I'm proposing is an after-the-fact, carefully calibrated approach to target bad actors. The approach that we have been living under the last couple of years is a preemptive, mother knows best, heavy set of regulations across the entire industry. And so to me, at least, those unintended consequences of those heavy-handed regulations are quite severe. And so I think the approach we take of transparency requirements of the FCC, Federal Trade Commission enforcement, is the right approach to take.
So two quick points. Number one, the FTC operates in two different ways. It enforces promises that companies make. That's actually very straightforward. That's not hard at all. And if the FCC is going to retain the transparency rule from 2010, that actually makes the FTC's job very easy. So anyone who says that's going to be complicated or the FTC is going to have a hard time with that really just doesn't understand that deception, which is that main core of the FTC's power, is very easy to wield. It does not require, contrary to what many people assume, a showing of harm. It simply says that consumers were promised something and didn't get it. Now, the more difficult question is, how does the FTC deal with other things that might happen? Anti-competitive practices, unfair practices, things that are not actually covered by the disclosure or that a company might disclose that might still be harmful to consumers. That's where the case-by-case approach is going to be more complicated. But the FTC has used that power to police data security and privacy in addition to its deception power. And if anything, has been very aggressive there. So I'm not concerned the FTC doesn't have the authority to police in this area. And if they do find that a company's done something bad, they're not just going to slap them on the wrist. They're going to put them under a very long consent decree. And once they're under that consent decree, they're really under the FTC's thumb. So that's the first point. The second is, we're not just talking about the FTC, because you might think here that this is just a question of trusting a Republican FTC. If anything, we're moving from a situation where you'd have to trust Ajit as a Republican appointee and other Republicans on the FCC to a situation in which, yes, there's the FTC, a federal agency that's run by Republicans, but also the state attorney generals, all Democratic state attorney generals, 16 of them, whatever there are out there, they'll be able to bring consumer protection actions to enforce their laws and the antitrust laws. And that's a part of a layered approach that will protect consumers.
But let's have a thought experiment here, because there are many who say regulating after the fact does not prevent the bad behavior, which is why you need the preemptive. But of course, there's a good argument to say the preemptive regulation stifles experimentation in the marketplace. But just for the purposes of a hypothetical here, because a lot of these harms are hypothetical, after these rules are repealed, there's no blocking rule, right? So it's gone. Now, of course, companies may promise not to block traffic. Some may not. Let's say a company waits till the rules are gone and blocks something and the FCC cannot enforce and they didn't promise not to block. And their customers, because they live in a rural area or somewhere, don't really have the switching mechanism to say, I don't like this ISP, I go to another one. Are we essentially relying now on media outrage or Twitter outrage to police companies if they don't promise not to block?
Well, two different responses. Number one, the transparency requirement we adopt would enforce or would demand that those companies disclose those kinds of practices. And I do think there would be some sort of social reputational effect to that kind of behavior. But secondly, especially if you're talking about a market where there's less competition, the switching costs, et cetera, are prohibitive or non-existent, there's not an opportunity to switch. That's a classic case of, for the FTC to look into is, does this company have market power? Are they exercising that market power in an anti-competitive way? I mean, these are squarely within the competition authority's bailiwick, and I think it's much better for us at the FCC and for consumers ultimately for us to take that calibrated approach as opposed to preemptively saying everybody will be treated as an anti-competitive monopolist.
You also have to ask, what difference does getting rid of the blocking rule make? To understand that, you have to go back and look at what the D.C. Circuit actually said. Judge Srinivasan, the Democrat who helped to uphold the FCC's rules here, was very careful to say these rules don't raise a First Amendment challenge because they don't apply at all to a provider that wants to curate the online experience. In other words, even if these rules stayed on the books today, blocking actually would be allowed for that very reason, in order to avoid a First Amendment problem. So for that reason, as well as another statutory issue about Congress having given immunity to online service providers, including internet access providers, for blocking objectionable content, the FCC really wouldn't have been able to enforce that blocking rule in the way that everyone assumes anyway. So actually, if you just have the transparency rule in place, I actually think that things don't really change on the FCC side. But the FTC is able to essentially do the kind of enforcement that the FCC would have been able to do anyway.
So one of the issues that comes up in tech policy a lot, not just net neutrality and telecom, but in general, is that the internet is an inherently interstate entity. It's a global entity. And we've seen that when federal government does things that certain states dislike, so we're going to imagine that many Democrat-run states are going to object to what you're doing today and going forward, are we going to see a patchwork of telecom regulation result from this? Are we going to see states say, just like they did with broadband privacy when Congress repealed certain broadband privacy rules, we saw state bills popping up all over the country. Are we going to see state-based net neutrality, state-based Title II coming out of this or not?
So one of the things that our order includes is a provision that says, to the extent that a state or local government is adopting a rule that is in conflict with the federal deregulatory policy over this information service, interstate information service, then that rule or regulation is preempted. And that is just basic law. I think that if there's an interstate service, then the federal government has a regulatory authority, and we don't want that to be disrupted with, as you pointed out, a patchwork of conflicting state and local requirements.
So there is a preemption of state authority here?
That is correct.
Are there any concerns over federalism, states' rights, local control? Or
no, as I said, this is an inherently interstate service. If I send an email to you in this very room, the chances are that that communication alone would traverse numerous different boundaries. And so to the extent it's an interstate information service we're talking about, the federal government sets policy. That's a long, well-established principle, not just in the communications law field, but I think in many other fields.
But just remember, the FCC is preempting communications regulation. They're not preempting, as
correct,
I understand it, enforcement of laws of general applicability, meaning the antitrust laws and consumer protection laws.
That's correct.
So you can still have a Democratic AG trying to enforce against a broken promise. Part of the discussion around net neutrality has been also about the process under which the FCC does things. Now, under the prior administration, we saw a party line vote. Things kind of fell along right and left. We're likely to see a similar situation, unfortunately, this time around. Is there anything different about the way that your FCC has taken on this issue as opposed to the prior? Or should people looking at this essentially see there was an election, the FCC changed hands in terms of the party that controls it, and now we're just basically seeing a 180 switch from one policy to another? Is there anything else going on here?
To me, at least, we are taking a much more fact-based approach. For example, the FCC's chief economist, who was in the office when the prior administration adopted these heavy-handed regulations, he himself called the FCC an economics-free zone. That is not the case in this order. As you'll see, we have an entire section that's devoted to careful economic analysis of some of the impacts of these regulations. The second major difference is that we are being much more open and transparent. In 2014 and 2015, the FCC waited until weeks after these regulations were adopted to actually reveal them to the American people. Tomorrow, Wednesday, we're actually going to be publicly releasing this order so that every American anywhere can see it. And that's 3 weeks before the vote, over 3 weeks, because we want people to be able to understand the rationale for our decision making.
Does that public view serve any purpose other than just having an extra 3 weeks? I mean, is there any scenario under which you can see public backlash changing your mind? Or is it just nice in theory to have the federal government telling you what it's going to do before it does?
Well, to me at least, this is not a sole proprietorship, as my predecessor once infamously said, that we have to, whatever order the FCC adopts here or in any area has to have three votes. And I think a majority of the commissioners is always open to getting input from the public about some of our proposed decisions. That input in the past has been quite disinformed, I think, because they haven't had insight into what exactly the agency was thinking about doing. And so here, at least, we've set the contours of the debate, that people can understand it, they may disagree with it, and now at least they have the right to understand it and to respond.
But there's two dimensions of transparency here. That's one of them. The other one is making sure that the chairman isn't just ramming this through and shoving it down the other commissioner's throat. So the problem in the past is that past chairmen, both Democrats and Republicans, have not only waited until after the vote to publish something, they waited until long after the vote to publish something. And that sometimes went weeks. And in that period after the vote, the chairman was still editing the order. In other words, the important thing here is this is really about making the reigning in the imperial chairmanship, if you will, making this truly a collegial body where the negotiation happens in the 3 weeks between the release of the draft and the vote on the order, and then it's done. We don't I hope just keep editing the document in ways that are under the control of the chairman. We actually vote on it, it's done, and then we have a public document. And when that finally is published in the Federal Register, if someone wants to, then they can sue, right? That's how this is supposed to work.
No offense, but having it 3 weeks early is probably not going to get me to read the entire thing either way.
Well, luckily, if the tryptophan from your turkey doesn't kick in, this order, all 200 some pages of it could help.
Just some light family 200. Reading.
So, okay. Not right, bad 200. Compared to 390 last time?
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember what the ultimate page count was last time.
But... Hashtag shorter FCC orders. That's a win for everybody, right?
Yeah.
So... Of course, there's going to be a court challenge, right? I mean, it's just essentially a foregone conclusion because under the prior FCC, they passed an order. There was an immediate court challenge, which is still playing out, which we talked about on other episodes. And we assume there's going to be a court challenge to your order. Does that worry you at all?
No, I mean, it's unfortunate that everyone in the United States won't be self-evidently convinced of the legal foundation that we've provided, so they're probably going to sue. But ultimately, I think that we've made the right decision based on the facts and the law. And the Supreme Court, having explicitly blessed this approach to Title I regulation of broadband in the Brand X case in 2005, and the FCC having carefully walked through the path prescribed by the Administrative Procedure Act in terms of, you know, proposing something, getting comments back, assessing those comments and rendering it an informed judgment. I feel pretty confident about our chances, but we'll see how things play out.
And Baron, you are a self-described lawyer. Do you also agree with that assessment?
The California DC bar also described me as lawyer. So just for the record. I do. So just to break this down a little bit. So remember that these issues are generally resolved under Chevron, which is the doctrine that says that courts defer to agencies on ambiguous statutes, and that when an agency changes its mind, then there's a requirement for the agency to justify that change. So those are the two hoops that the agency is going to have to jump through here. I think actually that's not going to be particularly difficult. The last chairman completely dismissed any sort of reliance interests that had been placed upon the understanding that had been in place for at least 12 years, if not 20 or more. Upon the Title I determination. So that's going to be relatively easy. Now, we would argue, we've argued in the litigation that's going on at the Supreme Court, that actually Chevron shouldn't even apply here if the agency is imposing broad claims of regulatory power, right? In other words, that would be a major question. That was not presented to the Supreme Court in the Brand X case, because the Brand X case was about the FCC, if you will, disclaiming broad authority and instead taking a light touch. And so the court didn't address that issue there. We think actually that the agency should win here on Chevron, but also that the kind of claims that were made in 2010 and 2015 really do implicate fundamental questions about the most important communications regulation network in the history of mankind, as Tom Wheeler said, and that's a major question that only Congress can decide. So that's another reason why we think actually the agency is likely to win here, because actually regulating would require a clear statement from Congress.
Yeah, in a nutshell, you're saying that to say you don't have authority gets different scrutiny than to claim lots of authority.
Precisely.
Right? So previous administrations, FCC, they passed this big, you know, monumental thing that a lot of people supported, and now you're in charge of the agency. You forcefully dissented back in 2014 and 15. Have you changed your mind at all? Is there anything you like about that previous order? Is there anything you learned in the intervening years that you know, might be different than your mindset back then?
At this point, we're talking about 2 to 3 years ago, so I'd have to mine
ancient history.
I was going to say in this area, but in looking at the record this time around, I do think with respect to the transparency rule, we wanted to make sure that, of course, we had a sound legal foundation for adopting that rule with modifications, but also we understood the economic impact of that and the policy impact of it. And I think when people read the order, they'll understand that, particularly in this marketplace that we have, that transparency rule backed up with FTC enforcement is a very powerful tool, I think, for promoting some of the benefits that the Title II order 2 years ago was designed to capture. capture, but avoiding a lot of the costs in terms of the unintended consequences of preemptive regulation. And I think the power of that combination is something that really informed my thinking over the last couple of months.
So, Barron, if you oppose the rules and the chairman opposes the rules, why not just get rid of the rules? Why does it matter that the order includes new interpretations of FCC legal authority? Is that about, you know, future-proofing, or what is that all about?
Yeah, because those interpretations are hugely problematic. So even though the FCC tried to edit down Title II into something less than the full-blown common carriage regulation a la railroads in the 1880s, any future chairman could impose all of that. So that's really the big effect on broadband investment and deployment, is that you have that uncertainty looming out there, that you could have price controls and all sorts of FCC regulation of broadband. But it's more than that, because those claims of legal authority end up affecting internet companies, tech companies, edge companies like Google and Facebook, and small companies too. The kinds of small entrepreneurs that joined us in our lawsuit against the FCC's rules. And it's worth explaining here just really quickly that, so Title II, the FCC imposed on broadband, but the way that they did that really opened the door to designating other forms of communications as common carrier services. And the thing that I'll be looking for in the order when it's out is how the commission talks about the reclassification of wireless. Because the way that the commission had to go about that in the 2015 order essentially said that anything that uses an IP address might be subject to common carriage regulation. And if that's true, that opens the door to the FCC regulating all sorts of things online. Any sort of voice communications, whether that's traditional VoIP service or doing the sort of voice services that happen for video gaming or think about the Amazon Alexa, all of those things are potentially subject to FCC regulation as common carriers. And that's just the Title II part. Then the 706 part, the thing the FCC invoked in 2010, saying that was an independent grant of authority. Well, if it is, that grant of authority applies not just to broadband, but to all forms of communication. So that would allow the FCC really broad discretion in regulating really a lot of the internet.
A lot of the controversy over this issue is not necessarily about the rules, but it's about the relationship that a customer has with their broadband company. And I don't think I'm saying anything out of line here when I say that people don't necessarily enjoy that relationship, or they have memories of long phone calls, phantom fees. Would you like to take the last couple minutes we have before, I know you have to get back to Reese's flavored coffee and a well-deserved siesta. Should people be expecting anything different about the broadband marketplace going forward if they have anxiety about switching costs or not being able to change, or a lack of competition? And there's lots of factors there, including population density, et cetera, et cetera. It's a complicated marketplace. But what should people be looking for after this in terms of broadband deployment and your chairmanship?
Well, to me, at least, they need to recognize, number one, that if that is their concern, that these heavy-handed regulations actually take them in the opposite direction of where they want to go. It dissuades more competition, it depresses investment, and ultimately makes internet access worse worse for consumers. Additionally, the FCC has a whole suite of initiatives that we've started to promote more competition. We've encouraged, for example, innovative satellite companies to enter the marketplace with low-Earth orbit satellites that could use the airwaves to beam, a pretty fast alternative to the terrestrial providers. We've encouraged companies to experiment with more high-band spectrum to get wireless services into the next generation of 5G technology, as it's called. And so if competition is the concern, then the FCC is front and center in adopting forward-looking policies. And with respect to these heavy-handed regulations, however, we want to take a fresh look, because it actually takes us in the wrong direction for people who are concerned about competition.
All right. Well, we're out of time, and I'll let you get back to your completely free day with nothing on your schedule at all. thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. That's Chairman Ajit Pai of the FCC for a return appearance on the show. And I'd like to say the last time you came on this show, it remains our most downloaded episode. So I encourage you to share it and make it. And let's beat that record and
grow the pie higher, as President Bush famously said.
Oh, my goodness. All right. And thank you, Barron, not just for that, but for also joining the show. President of Tech Freedom, Barron Token.
Thanks for having me.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of this show and the death of the internet as we know it. Make sure to use up that internet before it's gone forever. Water those crops on Farmville. Do whatever you got to do to enjoy these last few days of society. Write a review in the iTunes store of this podcast, because it really helps others find the show. And thanks for listening.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.